Das ist der Materie-Podcast. Mein Name ist Alm. Girls and Gods nennt sich eine aktuelle Filmdoku von Verena Soltitz und Arash Teriahi. Das Drehbuch dafür hat Inna Shevchenko geschrieben, die als Aktivistin der ukrainischen feministischen Bewegung der Femen vor 15 Jahren weltbekannt wurde. Ihr Film beleuchtet das Verhältnis der drei abrahamitischen Religionen zu Frauen und insbesondere zu institutionskritischen, reformorientierten Gruppen in den Religionsgesellschaften selbst. Wie sie ihre Religionskritik durch dieses Filmprojekt geschärft hat, erfahren wir im nun folgenden Gespräch. Welcome to Materie Podcast, Inna Shevchenko.
Thank you. Happy to talk.
Yes, let's talk. You have been, let's say, globally famous for quite a bit. You have been or still are part of a movement called Femen in Ukraine. And I vividly remember a scene from 2012 when you took a chainsaw and cut down a cross in Kiev. Why was that?
It's also probably one of the images I remember. One of those images that I will never forget, probably never wipe out from my memory and from my own story. Well, that particular action was done against the Russian Orthodox Church and its political influence it had at that time and still has, or even more so today, in Russia and in Ukraine as well, and claims its political, you know, role in everything that has happened in those respective societies. And it was an action of solidarity, a female solidarity, an activist solidarity with the activist of Pussy Riot that on that day were condemned to jail sentence. Well, and that's the action that also changed a lot of things in my own life because I had to flee immediately, almost immediately, from Ukraine because the president of that time, Viktor Yanukovych, publicly demanded my arrest for insulting feelings of believers. Of course, the speakers of Russian Orthodox Church also were enjoying commenting on that action. And it also changed a lot for the movement itself because I arrived to France and from that moment and from that place, the movement had a chance to become international and reach out to women across Europe, but also then beyond. Latin America, in America, groups were just popping up on their own without our specific efforts. So that's how Femen also became international movement first. And then from my point of view, I think that some activists might not agree, some of those who are still involved in the movement might not agree, but from my point of view, Femen as an idea, as an aesthetic, and as a political tactic became bigger than the movement itself. And we saw how it started serving other, or was used by other groups and social movements. And that is how I understood that probably, you know, the phenomenon became bigger than us. And yeah, that's the story.
Okay, since you mentioned groups, there was also a music group, German-American industrial group KMFDM. They used your activity on one
cool.
of their
yeah.
album covers, Kunst.
Yes.
So you know it, of
that
course.
That was great,
yeah.
yes.
yeah. I was wondering whether they got in touch with you.
No, but I did see the cover of the mm-hmm. album. And of course, it was actually coming, you know, in this time when it was a very tough time where, you know, you all of a sudden have to flee your country. All political groups in your country and political authorities condemn you, and there are a lot of threats, political threats, death threats from all sorts of directions. And the supports like this were very important to me at that time. And yeah, they were certainly noticed. So yeah, thank you.
yeah, well, you're welcome. You mentioned the Russian Orthodox Church. Now that there is a war going on between Ukraine and Russia, the Russian Orthodox Church calls itself in Austria the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. But is there any difference, really?
Oh, there is a fundamental difference from political perspective,
yeah.
if you look at it. In the current political environment, in the war environment, certainly, Well, I think that many people ignore, in general, and in particular with the case of Russia and Ukraine, the role of the church and the role of religious institutions as such in shaping political environment and political, you know, political arena as such. So Russian Orthodox Church, and in particular himself, Patriarch Kirill, were probably the most efficient instruments of installing Putin's dictatorship and authoritarian regime in Russia, which did not happen right away with the Putin's arrival. Russian Orthodox Church was very handy at suppressing political opposition and, you know, Pussy Riot, that was already a late stage. Mm-hmm. You know, there were a lot of episodes before of silencing many people, but also of, you know, within, inside the churches, the priests do not preach morality. They preach political obedience to the Putin's regime. And the inside countries like Ukraine, Russian Orthodox Church also worked efficiently and very hardly, putting a lot of resources for many years. And basically, you know, if you want, I can with full confidence say that in Ukraine, Russian Orthodox Church was just purely a political mafia. It, you know, that had a lot of power over civilian population through, again, I mean, this narratives of morality and covering itself up as the agents of morality and, you know, and all the right and good things. But the political work was done very efficiently, and infiltration of the society as such was done through the church. So the difference between the two, you know, is very political, certainly. And, you know, while, of course, all the churches that were controlled and are still are connected to Russian Orthodox Church inside Ukraine, they are very much pro, you know, ties with Russia, mm-hmm. and even sort of in the current situation of negotiation where Ukraine is supposed to be forced into negotiating with Russia, in those churches, this is presented as a path for peace, the Jesus, message of peace, and this can be reached by just giving up to the biggest aggressor in our history. And of course, Ukrainian church here in this case represents a very patriotic element, you know, in this whole setting. But, you know, the church is the church and religion is the religion in both cases.
And is there such a thing as a religion that does not exert power or use power or oppress people to gain political power? Can you think of any example where it's different?
Speaking of monotheisms, no, I cannot.
No, not
my
really.
Answer is very short, no.
I can't either, but that.
No, I mean, look. Surprise. Even if we let's detach ourselves from Russia and Ukraine, right? Which is a difficult case, and here it's purely political, because religion and church in particular in this case is a political element, and they do not even pretend not to be, you know. But let's look at any other place in the world where we are disturbed by the situation, you know, and how it affects the civilian population. I mean, of course, Iran comes up right away, right? And it is a religious dictatorship where, you know, the revolution was staged. They were revolutionaries who were supposed to overthrow the dictatorship, and they did, bringing in a religio-political autocracy. And today, of course, those who are suffering the most there are women. The most obvious case of victims of such a regime and religion and with its political ambitions are women who literally cannot step out of their home and walk in the street, you know, just the way they are without carrying the political flag on their body. Look anywhere else. I mean, the worst case, I guess, today of a country is Afghanistan. And this is obviously also, you know, the role of religion in installing such a horrible regime where women are just disqualified fully, completely from public life. It's also done with religion.
Of course. And you drew a neat line from your own activism to the plot or the theme of your film documentary. Is there such a direct line? Was that something that is directly linked to what you did like 10 or 15 years ago? Or is there something else that contributed to your idea to make that movie? Or is it your movie documentary alone?
It's both. There is a very, you know, it's a very logical continuation of everything I've done before, in a sense that I do exactly the same thing here. I go into the places where I'm not supposed to go and I ask questions I'm not supposed to ask. So in that sense, it's a very logical continuation. On the other hand, the need, my personal need, was to do such a film. Was also, well, it's also logical. I mean, it's just in echo with everything else. I was very pissed. I'm very often very pissed. But in this case, I was pissed with the new trends that are taking place within social movements, within and in particular feminism itself, where we gave up. Too often we see feminists giving up the very fundamental cause for which we all claim to, you know, to fight, which is women and liberation of women. And we too often there are cases where feminist groups, the feminist movement, converged with other social fights. They converged, which is great, but they converged to the point that they were ready to give up their own fundamentals, where, you know, feminists would not dare to talk about gender segregations in certain communities or in certain groups just because they don't want to be labeled as either Islamophobes or racist or any other of those things. So I understand the intention, but if the cost was not too high, you know, because by doing that, we gave up too many women. We basically abandoned too many women, including those very Iranian women who were so counting on the support of Western feminists, you know. What happened in Iran was actually, I'm lucky I could witness it in my lifetime, because I think what we all witnessed was a true feminist revolution. And it took place not in Paris, not in Berlin, not in Vienna. It took place in Iran, on the streets of Tehran and Isfahan. But those women were alone, and they're still alone.
Yeah. Do you think they feel betrayed by European women wearing headscarves?
I don't think. I talked to them. I did talk to them, and I know there is a lot of incomprehension of this silence. They don't understand. I mean, in the film, we talked to Mahsa Alinejad, to other Iranian women, but I also talked to Narges Mohammadi, who got the Nobel Peace Prize, and who is in Iran, who is herself is still persecuted by this regime, who was imprisoned numerous times. They do not understand this hesitation of women in the West, who just sort of say, well, yeah, Iranian women are brave, but that's their fight. How come? Since when? Oppression of women in another part of the world became not your fight. This is something that, you know, this frustration led me to going into the place where nobody basically wanted to go, you know, and ask questions and pose these uncomfortable questions that nobody wants to ask anymore. I think that we got so much, we played too much into this polarization and, you know, sort of feeling so comfortable with closing ourselves in the safe spaces where people just think exactly like yourself. And we just, you know, we basically sit around the mirrors and we look into the mirrors and hear exactly the same thing that are ringing in your head. Yeah. And that is that doesn't bring anybody anywhere. You know, we don't walk forward at all. And so I got very frustrated, very pissed by this environment, and I wanted to show that uncomfortable questions can be asked, uncomfortable answers can be heard, can be taken, and we can debate, we can argue, we can even have a fight, but we can still remain human. Because something that I learned throughout all these years of campaigning is that ideas, ideologies and institutions of which people become part of, they are very often much worse than the people. So in a sense that I learned that human beings and people, they are nicer than the ideologies they subscribe to. And another thing, which is also a very basic thing that I learned, but it changes everything when you remind yourself every time that ideas And opinions have tendency to, you know, to be changed. You can change opinions. And you do not change anybody's opinion if you just maintain your own truth and do not engage into debate. And I think it's in general very healthy to always test your own beliefs by encountering those who don't, who think the opposite, who believe the opposite. So that was the exercise in this film.
And an exercise well done, I would say. You were talking to quite many people from all the big Abrahamic monotheistic religions, which is Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. I can imagine you very often heard the argument that countries like Afghanistan or Iran, that religion is misinterpreted, is understood wrongly. This is just politics. This is just a cultural means of oppression and not really religion where all the problem comes from. What do you make of that?
Well, I got used to seeing this argument again and again and hearing it again and again. And I think that it's sort of, you know, that's how people try to convince themselves that what they believe in still has a chance to be considered good, separating religion from politics. They think that it's possible. It's not possible.
Is that true for all religions?
I mean, for monotheisms, yes. Yeah. And in different, of course, in different times in history, you know, there are different moments of, you know, of intensity for one or another religion. But I think that today, since Islam is the youngest from three monotheisms, certainly it's more ambitious in its political efforts. But Catholic Church maybe just got a little bit more mature and does it in a more subtle way, but it still exercises extreme political influence and power, including here in Europe, including in democratic societies. So yeah, I see, you know, whenever people say to me that those bad things about religion, they are not, this is not what religion is, but this is politics, I understand that this is the moment where this internal struggle is taking place. Because even when I talk to, you know, to the women who claim, who consider themselves and publicly declare themselves feminist while wearing, for example, a headscarf or calling themselves Muslim feminist, you know, there were years where I would consider them as my political opponents or even enemies, you know. But after engaging in discussions with those women, I understand, I saw these internal struggles that they have the whole time, where they do understand themselves that it does not work together. And they have to give up one or another, you know. They have to either go full force and defend, you know, religious tradition that is anti-feminist, anti-woman per se, or they have to sort of commit to being a feminist and defending their own case and say, well, this is wrong because it's political. It's not from my religion.
Yeah, gotcha. Girls and Gods, I think, is very interesting also on a psychological levels. If you correlate the religions and the behavior of the people and the women involved especially, I do this on a very, let's say, very abstract scale here. I think the Catholic Church seems benign, almost harmless, also the women involved, whereas Jewish women, they seem kind of dislocated from the outside world. They live in their own small bubble and they do not interfere that much. And with Islamic women, very, very closely linked to the religion itself, there is some sort of underlying aggression always, I perceive. Is this something, would you disagree here? I think
it's certainly not done on purpose. It's interesting that you saw that and felt that, but maybe that's also your, you know, your awareness of the communities of these respective religions and how they operate. The thing is that, if Christian women seem harmless, it's because Christianity reached a level where there are many efforts to reform it. And we encounter reformers. But on the very, like at the very same time, there are extreme cases like this March Pro-Life, I mean, where I think like some of the most violent and appalling behaviors are seen there and felt, and
the violence here,
you know, even if they might not be very loud and in their arguments, the violence of this group is that it's literally affects lives of women, because this is shaped into laws of so many countries. And in the United States, with the victory of Donald Trump, I mean, there was a wave of states that the first thing they did was to take away this right to abort from women. The same thing happened in Poland the moment the Conservative Party won with the support of Catholic Church. The first thing that was done, and against the very loud and very visible opposition from women, feminists, but also the society as such, the first thing they've done is to put in place one of the, well, the most, I think this is the most rigid abortion ban in Europe. The first thing that was done. So, as I said, you know, while Islam is the most, the youngest religion, it seemed to be very ambitious politically, but we should not underestimate the violence and the power of Catholic Church.
No, it's woven into the political fabric in Europe and also in America, especially United States, of course. But as you said, the groups of women engaging in religion here, very many of them have reformist approaches, like that small group of female priests here in Austria and also in the US.
Yeah.
They tried to change the structure within the religion and the church as an institution itself. Whereas Jewish and Muslim women here, they kind of conform a lot more. So their approaches are really different here. And especially with the Islamic women, they know all their arguments, how to explain why they conform and why they actually feel protected. So both examples you had in there, the woman from Germany and the one I think in the UK, mm-hmm. they kind of explain to you that they, especially the woman in the UK, that she gave up her freedom and her liberties deliberately to feel more freedom within the religion, because she doesn't have to think so much about the outside world and the perception of her as a person in her life anymore. So do you think that these types of normalization of behavior is actually more dangerous than direct propaganda of the religion itself?
Well, I mean, let's clarify that here you talk about two women who defend hijab. And they talk, what was interesting for me with their case is that they defend it from actually very different perspectives. And if you put their arguments together, they do not really agree. You know, one mm-hmm. says, one clearly says that everybody who claims themselves to be a Muslim must submit to the will of God. And if you submit to the will of God, you have to cover your head and so on and so forth. The other one says that her headscarf is her empowerment, and that's basically her feminist statement. You know, so she adopts sort of the language of feminism and the slogans like "My body, my rules," basically. So I thought that this is very interesting to show that there is no homogeneity either, inside those groups. And they also use different perspectives and different angles to push forward the agenda. You know, whether they are dangerous, I do think that these tendencies are very dangerous, and probably the one of the religious feminism is maybe even more dangerous than just saying straightforward Islam is a submission. Where, for example, we saw this wave. It's actually started quite some time ago. Such a term, religious feminism, and it's largely connected to Islamic feminism, was born, I think, in 1990s. So it's been a while already that this work is being done. And I guess today we see the result of this decades of building such a narrative, where hijab and all the modesty dress is detached completely from the concepts that, you know, that that are in their foundation, such as woman's body being an aura, which means being dirty, being sinful, and therefore having to be, you know, hidden, that woman's body belonging sort of to husband and father and brother, and therefore having to be covered from the public. So it's completely detached today from this narrative, and feminist narratives such as this is clothes like any other, or this is, you know, my body, my rules, and I choose what to wear, where we see where, like, it's a feminist language is used to basically whitewash very sexist, some of the most sexist practices that are imposed on women, their bodies and their lives. So I guess this is very dangerous. And unfortunately, we can see how many fell into this trap. Mm-hmm. Including many feminists.
Have you watched the headscarf debate we had here in Austria lately, where a new law is going to be passed banning headscarves for children, girls in schools?
I mean, I'm aware of the initiative and of the law. I haven't closely followed the debates and the opinions that were expressed. But
I mean, they're
maybe
the same everywhere. Everywhere. You have, like, people who are saying girls can choose for themselves what they wear. Even mm-hmm. when they grow older, it's part of their self-empowerment to mm-hmm. to make that choice. Mm-hmm. And they always can terminate or stop wearing the headscarf. And there is the other fraction that basically says at a young age they're not really able to choose. Also, there is an age where you become aware of your religion, which is 14, and before that age you're not deemed free to choose. So that choice is being made for you also in order to prevent any forcing of that outfit or any other religious traditions on young women. So this is basically the argument goes always like this.
Right. I mean, let's start with the choice.
Yeah.
Those who, like, I think it's always very useful whenever we hear this argument about choice, in particular when it's about children and young girls. Let's follow up with the question, choice between what and what? Like, what's the choice actually there? Because choice is always conditioned. There are always conditions for any choice that we are making. You know, I've spent quite some time with ex-Muslim women and women who took off their hijab, and all of them, most of them, would say that when they were wearing hijab, they did say to themselves, they were convinced that this is their choice, that they have chosen to do that, to wear that. When they took it off, and for the reasons they took it off, they understood that their choice was conditioned by fear. Because what these young women often choose between is, you know, following the rules, submitting to this tradition, covering yourself up, or being completely ostracized by your family, by your community. Sometimes there are extreme cases where, you know, they just disown completely. Because they, you know, their body is supposed to carry the honor of entire family and entire community. And the moment they took off the headscarf, you know, they sort of put a shame on entire mm-hmm. family. So many of those women risked that. And the choice was always between, you know, very basically violent and extreme cases. So I think that this is always very interesting to hear the choice, like, what's the choice actually? Let's talk about that. Of course, I'm a very fierce proponent of keeping religion completely away from education. If you claim to be a secular state, and if the education is offered by state, then education must be secular. And secular doesn't mean this reinterpretation of secularism that we had in the recent years, where secularism right now is understood as if everybody in the same pot with their own narratives, their own propaganda, you know, having a space.
I know, it's merely a system of state religions.
Right, exactly.
Instead of having one state religion here in Austria, we have 16 state religions.
That's it.
We also have an Islam law, as you might know here, which is also a funny contradiction because in Austria there is a law for Islam. But at the same time, we're not allowing young girls to wear headscarves in schools. So we say that there is a problem within that religion. And it's also, we have been made aware also by politics that this is a problem because we say it's a symbol of oppression and young girls are not supposed to wear that symbol of oppression. Mm-hmm. But then again, we have a law mm-hmm. that grants that same religion more rights than other beliefs and worldviews.
Yeah, the thing is that I think that this is a problem like Western societies, again, they are so confused between their own, you know, being prisoners of their own past, of colonialism and so on and so forth, that they bring, you know, into this kind of imposing guilt on themselves still today in many things that they're in the laws that they shape today and seeing the reality where they definitely understand, and this truth comes not from a white Western feminist. This truth comes from Muslim women, from women from the Muslim world themselves, many of whom are refugees for the simple, you know, fact that they refused mm-hmm. to just become these tools of political ideologies such as Islamism, and many of them ran away here to the West. To save themselves, you know, and to find this freedom that they were lacking there. So there is certainly a dissonance between those two. But, you know, I would like to make a point about this law mm-hmm. in Austria. To me, you know, I'm always in favor of prohibiting religion in education. All religions, you know, keeping education free from any proselytism, religious proselytism. And I'm very much in favor of keeping children protected from religious traditions that really shape their life until the age where they are able to make this conscious choice. And offering them this possibility to form, you know, such a consciousness where they know they can choose it. However, what I thought that this law in Austria, it seemed to me like a lazy politics. Because just banning headscarf, first of all, I think it's just a weak politically decision because why don't you ban all religious symbols? You immediately become...
You know why.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, you immediately become... Yeah. You immediately, like, you know, you like it's so... It's immediately... You give a space for an attack right away. You basically... Yeah, you target one community. It's just too easy. You know, this is really lazy politics. And indeed, yeah, you do target one community.
That is not okay.
You
target also one gender because they explicitly put in girls
right.
in that law.
Exactly.
Which wouldn't have been necessary at all.
Exactly. And that is what with respect, I would say it's lazy politics, but we can also use other terms to describe that. And then, you know, just like any ban in a democracy, what does this imply? Banning something does not liberate anybody without a complex educational work behind that, where children understand the reasons of such ban, where parents also have an opportunity to learn, you know, and not just feel that they are rejected, ostracized or attacked, you know, for mm-hmm. their identity, because that is just having a reverse effect. I will bring here an example of France, where there is a law since 2008, where they ban all ostentatious, meaning visible, religious symbols in school. And this law is not only for children, it's also for teachers, for educators, and for parents who enter on the territory of educational institutions. So a mother cannot come with a burqa mm-hmm. inside a school to pick up her kids. So this is a commitment that was, of course, very discussed, and there were a lot of debates. But this is a commitment that a secular state, and in France, secularism is considered even more radical by some, because it's not just separation of church and state. It's not just separation of religious institutions and state. It is a freedom of state, from religion. And that is much more, it's a different meaning there. And so education is kept really free from any religious influence. Public school, you know, there are no religious classes in French public school.
Yeah.
There are classes of laïcité, of secularism, where cartoons of Charlie Hebdo are discussed and shown to children. The drawings of Muhammad are showed there, and also the terrorist attack against Charlie Hebdo cartoonist for this cartoon is also discussed and debated. So that is what secular school is. That is what, you know, the efforts of protecting children and offering them these years of free from religion education, where they can come out of the school and make those conscious choices. Because, you know, it's also, as much as I don't like those ideologies, traditions, I'm much more committed to freedom of conscience and beliefs and freedom of speech. And I do understand that this implies that an adult person in a free and democratic society is supposed to have a right to choose a conservative lifestyle, to leave, you know, and submit to an ideology that I dislike. Right? But so that choice must be done by an adult person consciously. And as long as they don't try to impose it on me, I'm supposed to, and I have to, accept it and defend as a right. And that is how free society works. But when you do the opposite, you know, that you don't raise free and conscious adults who can make such a choice.
So you think the concept of separation and church and state, like laïcité in France by the separation law of 1905, is a bit overarching. I mean, it stems from a time where politics really had to have some effort to push out religion of all these institutions. But now, 100 years later, it might seem a bit overarching, because also it's a discrimination between beliefs that are non-religious and religious, and it only is directed against religious beliefs. Did I understand you correctly here?
Oh, no. Well, I don't think that there is any attack on beliefs. There is an attack, if you want to use even the word.
No, not attack. It's a defense.
Exactly.
It's not an attack.
From an influence of those beliefs in a public space and in particular education. Yeah. I mean, the children, certainly there are so many Muslim children in French schools, so Christian and Jewish. I mean, they go to public schools, and outside schools, they, you know, they live the life with traditions and culture and beliefs of their families. But whenever they interact with the state and education is offered by the state, they cannot manifest those beliefs as long as they are, you know, in those spaces. And I think that this is not about beliefs. It's about traditions, about rules that shape, you know, the society as such. And keeping those spaces, such educational spaces, free from traditions and rules and laws of religions, that's what guarantees this coexistence. You know, we talk a lot about coexistence, and I do think that the best recipe so far we had, the best scenario so far we found of coexistence, is not having everybody have right to bring their ideologies into the same space, but actually having spaces free from those ideologies.
Okay, I gotcha. Yeah. So you weren't actually criticizing that other beliefs would be allowed and only religious beliefs are not allowed.
Oh, no, sure.
So do you think that France is a role model then in how we should address the separation of republic and religion, or could it be better than France?
Well, I think that we really struggle around the world, and in democracies really struggle still. I mean, for so many centuries, we struggled to build a society free from political influence that religious institutions claim to, you know, they fight so much to have it. France certainly is one of the examples where I think many things were done right. And of course, there are historical reasons. And I mean, the Enlightenment, Les Lumières, they open up a lot of arguments and valid arguments against religion. And they were intellectually brave to sort of go into it. But I think that France is also failing on many fronts. But yeah, I think that France certainly must be considered as one of the successful examples.
I mean, there is not many. I think worldwide there is only 12 countries that have laïcité in their constitution, but that also includes countries like China or Portugal, where there is a concrete date. So it's.
Right.
And even Turkey, and the Turkish laïcité is not laïcité, it's laïcism.
No.
It's actually a cooperation between state and religion, or technically it's having religion on a leash, so that there is no freedom of religion.
I think,
really.
Turkey is actually a very interesting example you bring up, because let's mention who brought this idea to Turkey. It was Atatürk, and from time of Atatürk and till the time of Erdogan, many things changed. I mean, the narrative maybe and the word and the law stayed, but the moment Erdogan took political power, of course, religion became immediately very handy, because what he wanted to build and what he is building is a authoritarian regime,
yeah.
And religion right away became an instrument.
It was served as an instrument even by the laws that were already in place, and he could use it to exert the same power as Russia and Putin now
exactly.
does in Russia.
Yeah.
And as Trump tries to do in the United States. So that the pattern is reoccurring here. At the end of the documentary, you said you always thought that we need to destroy religion, but actually changing the position of women is a major revolution here. Is it even possible, and this is a large infringement on human rights, how religion treat women, but do you think that religions can be made compatible with human rights per se?
You know, I remained with my convictions and my beliefs throughout the whole journey of those sometimes uncomfortable debates, of hearing the really opinions of, like, really opposite opinions that I dislike. What, however, I found and discovered throughout this journey is that the efforts of reformists, which before I thought were absolutely, lost cause, I saw how much opposition they face for their efforts within those institutions. Some of those women live with the police protection 24/7. They live with death threats. Some of them have to change their home like regularly, because there is such a pressure on them for simply saying, well, women can also preach, or women can also take authority. So I understand what they are doing is that indeed this might be a silent and invisible revolution. Something that is, of course, not the type of the revolution that I or we imagine, with the, where you just ditch everything and sort of destroy everything and, hang the kings and, install a very different regime. They are doing it silently, quietly, very often invisibly, but something is happening there. And the proof is the opposition that they face from the authority of those institutions. So I ended up with a lot of respect for them. They're certainly taking a lot of risk and they're brave enough. And then, throughout the years of my campaigning, I do understand that as much as I like my slogans, there comes a time where you gotta go beyond them. Because, the slogans make you loud and heard, maybe, but asking questions and just shutting up to hear an answer of someone who thinks not like you is a chance to maybe understand the other one or maybe be understood. And I thought it's worth trying. And at the end of the day, I'm not here to resolve things for others. It's already tiring and tough enough to resolve things for yourself. And as much as I believe I resolved certain things, in particular question of religion, for myself, I don't claim to have power or capacity to resolve it for others. So I thought that my role here will be to ask a question and let people try to resolve it for themselves.
That makes a lot of sense. And very often I think there is a theoretical solution, a clean theoretical solution that you might want to have, but you see that reality is a lot different and you need to be pragmatic. And I think when it comes to women in religion, very often it's better to have a reformation, make life better for many instead of looking for something that you cannot really achieve here. And I think in the end, you sum it up neatly. Did you put it? Not colleagues, not friends.
I said that I know that one day they will be on our side.
Yeah.
Meaning that they will be on their own side, you know, because that's another thing that was interesting for me that came out from all these discussions, and especially even the most heated conversations in the film, is that I saw how with completely, you know, opposite arguments, we do try to claim the same. We want to say that what I'm doing brings me to my self-liberation and gives me an agency and gives me dignity. So behind those arguments, there is the same démarche. We all want to have freedom. We all want to be able to choose and convince ourselves that this is a free choice. We all want to convince others that we're empowered by what we're doing. So, yeah, if you really look beyond the words that are said, and as much as you don't like those words, sometimes you're able to recognize that we come from the same place and we want to arrive at the same place. We just, yeah, we walk very different paths. And sometimes on the way, we hit each other because those paths are just, you know, the opposite of each other. But yeah, I learned to see that in majority, people are much more beautiful and nicer than the ideologies they subscribe to.
Yeah, and we leave our listeners with that and with the recommendation to go and see Girls and Gods. Thank you, Ina,
Thank
for being
you.
Here.
Thank you.